Next speaker is Joe Polchinski from the KITP in Santa Barbara, and he'll speak on ADS-CFT and integrability.
Okay, I don't have any really new results to report, and so my talk will have two main parts. The first part is just some general remarks about ADS-CFT duality and its connection with integrability, and the second part will be about the Pomeran. The Pomeran played an important role in the history of string theory, and for different reasons it played an important role in the history of integrability, and so I'd like to give a unified picture of the Pomeran. So, as other speakers have remarked, ADS-CFT is a realization of Tuft's old conjecture that a strongly coupled large N gauge theory could be rewritten as a string theory and solved in that way. It's also our most precise definition of what string theory is. That is, if we consider string theory in a space with ADS5 cross S5 boundary conditions, within that system we can calculate anything. For example, a process like scattering two gravitons at energies large compared to the Planck scale, they turn into a black hole and it decays. And the amplitude for this process can be calculated in principle by asking the dual gauge theory question. Of course, the dual gauge theory is strongly coupled, but you can do the calculation, again, in principle by simulating the gauge theory on a computer. Back in the 1960s, when Ken Wilson was trying to answer the question, what is field theory, the way we're now trying, what is quantum field theory, the way we're now trying to answer the question, what is string theory, his criteria for knowing the answer was if he could tell a computer what to do, and he allowed himself to imagine an arbitrarily large, arbitrarily fast computer. If you could tell a computer what to do, then you knew what the theory was. And here, for any question you can ask of string theory with these boundary conditions, we can satisfy Wilson's criteria and we can tell the computer what calculation to do to answer it to arbitrary accuracy. Also, by the way, this is a cartoon of ADS space, this cylinder, global ADS space, but we can make it arbitrarily large and arbitrarily flat by taking the Tuft parameter lambda and n sub c to be large. And so, in fact, this tells you to arbitrary accuracy the flat space prime properties of the fully quantized string theory. Now, that's a lot of information, but it's far from everything you'd like to know about string theory. And especially because string theory is a holographic theory, changing the boundary conditions changes things by a lot more than it does in an ordinary field theory. Changing the boundary conditions actually changes the degrees of freedom. And there are some simple things we know how to do. If you replace the 5-sphere with some perturbation of the 5-sphere or with something not too different than Einstein-Sasaki space, then you simply have a different dual gauge theory. A step more complex is to take ADS times a Calabi-Yau manifold with certain fluxes. These are also strongly believed to be solutions to string theory. They're part of the string landscape. And because it's an ADS factor, they should have duals, which are conformal field theories here in three dimensions. But the duals aren't known yet. This is a big open question. In these models, as in many cases, the string coupling is fixed. It's not something that you can dial up and down as you can in ADS5 cross S5, so you can't take a classical limit on either side of the duality. This is an intrinsically quantum system. So in particular, there is no perturbative gauge theory calculation to do. The coupling is of order 1 on both sides. And then even larger extensions of the idea would be to replace ADS with flat space-time or even more interesting, eternally inflating space-time. And this probably requires new concepts. And so knowing the string theory simply with ADS boundary conditions doesn't answer the whole question, but certainly it provides sort of the framework, a bit of solid information that's been the basis for guesswork as to how to understand string theory in these spaces. Now, ADS-CFT duality is still unproven. Now, of course, the many weak, strong dualities of string theory, and even some purely field theoretic dualities, like the weak, strong self-duality of the n equals 4 gauge theory. Of course, I told you that ADS-CFT could be regarded as a definition of string theory, so the question is, what is there to prove? But, of course, we have a lot of independent information about string theory, many different asymptotic expansions. So even without knowing completely one side of the duality, we have enough information that the ADS-CFT duality implies a large number of precise statements about the gauge theory, which are either true or false. The original derivation due to Maldacena was a side effect of trying to understand scattering off of black holes and the entropy of black holes. So the entropy of black holes was first understood by using the fact that as you vary the string coupling, you can adiabatically vary between perturbative D3 brains and black 3 brains, which have horizons and Bekenstein-Hawking entropies. If you take this interpolation and you simply drop on both sides to the low energy degrees of freedom, on the one side you get the N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, on the other side you get the ADS-5 cross S5 string theory. And so in some sense, the ADS-CFT derivation, if you assume that this diagram commutes, which basically means that there's no surprising low energy degrees of freedom coming down in between, then you get the duality. And that's very far from a definition, a proof that would satisfy skeptic. It's very far from a set proof at all. But this was the original argument that there was this duality, which for the first time involved on the one side of field theory and on the other side of string theory. And the clue that led to this was some unexplained agreements where a calculation in purely gravitational variables and a very different Feynman-Graf calculation of the same quantity were giving the same answer for no apparent reason. And that later on, that was a consequence of this duality plus supersymmetric protection. Another derivation, which I've heard in various forms from Banks and Strominger, I don't know who would claim to originate it, is the assertion that a 10-dimensional string theory is the same as a 4-dimensional gauge theory is so audacious, so crazy, that if it were false, you could show it very easily. And indeed, I mean, my first reaction to hearing this is crazy, and I started to make a list of reasons why it was crazy, and then I understood why my list, in fact, didn't work, And there's agreement in many regimes. There's exact supersymmetric results of various sorts. There's, of course, as you well know, at least qualitative and some quantitative agreement on the properties of long strings. The Reggie limit that I'll talk about, behavior of black holes. There's actually some numerical tests where there's a very limited set case where, in fact, using the light cone, people have actually calculated numerically the properties of strongly coupled gauge theories and verified that what the duality predicts is so. In fact, not only is it audacious, but you can bang on it. You can look in many, many, many different regimes of physics, and persistently the 10-dimensional gauge theory produces the physics that you would expect to see from a 4-dimensional string theory. Another sort of derivation is the statement that string theory, if you were willing to assume that it exists, in ADS-CFT, in ADS space-time, defines a conformal field theory on the boundary by using the dictionary laid out by these people. And so there is, by definition, some conformal field theory which is dual to string theory. That doesn't mean that it's N equals 4 super Yang-Mills, but N equals 4 super Yang-Mills is the only renormalizable field theory that has the right amount of supersymmetry, not to mention the other symmetries of the problem, conformal symmetry. It's the only known theory of any known field theory of any type that has this much supersymmetry and the space-time symmetries. And moreover, it doesn't have any free parameters that you could vary. So it's very hard for this duality to be wrong by a little bit, that it works to some order and then doesn't work. And so this argument, I think, is a very strong reason for believing that the duality, given that it's close, must be exact. There's no target on the CFT side that would be a little different from the N equals 4 theory. Now, in some sense, all of the dualities we know are sort of moral extensions of the self-duality of the Ising model, which was understood long ago. Except that the self-duality of the Ising model can be shown by direct path integral manipulations, classic manipulations that turn the weakly coupled representation into the strongly coupled one. And these manipulations have been completely useless for the interesting dualities that have been discovered in the last, well, have been discovered in the last 10 or more now years. So we have this very strange situation that we have, this very powerful conjecture that connects two very different things, gravity and gauge theory. We can't prove it and we can't disprove it. And of course, there are things like that in mathematics, like the Riemann hypothesis, which again are surprising connections that for a century or more, you can't prove or disprove. And usually when you have something like that in mathematics, it points to important concepts that you haven't yet discovered. And I think that's probably the same thing in ADS-CFT duality as well. Of course, it wouldn't surprise me greatly if the Riemann hypothesis were wrong. I have no great vested interest in it. It would surprise me a great deal if ADS-CFT were wrong. Now, what are these deep structures? I don't know. I don't know if integrability is part of it. Integrability seems like a rather special property, but maybe it's a special property that belongs to a larger class of properties. But in any case, it would certainly, given everything I've said, be extremely valuable to have as thorough as possible an understanding of even one example of duality. And so anything we can do to have not just the weakly coupled and strongly coupled limits, but a complete solution that interpolates would be very, very valuable. Okay, so the original conjecture was for a conformal gauge theory, but very quickly one sees that that's just, again, a point from which one can move in new directions. So this, what I'm showing you here is some running coupling constants, so energy and coupling. So the N equals 4 gauge theory is conformal. It has a constant coupling, and that coupling can take any value, but it has to be large if you want to be in the regime where the string coupling is good. The Wolschewitz coupling is weak, and the space-time curvature is small. The red curve here is the running coupling of QCD, the theory that you might want to study. What's not so hard to do once you have the N equals 4 duality is to break the conformal invariance in various ways so that past a certain point, the coupling starts to run. It, let's say, tracks the QCD curve. And this is what Igor described in more detail, where you have various theories that basically they're conformal and supersymmetric at high energy, but then at low energy, develop a mass gap, confinement, and all of the qualitative phenomena of QCD. Now, this exercise is also an existence proof, again, proof in the very loose sense, that there is a string theory of QCD, of large N QCD, because the upper end here, the asymptotic coupling, is a free parameter in the N equals 4 theory, and so you can move the blue line and the purple line up and down. As you move them down, well, you see that here is the ADS QCD moved down so it's straight and then follows QCD. So it shows you that you can continuously get from where we are to a string theory of QCD as a limit. The problem is that as the coupling drops below one, the dual string theory is moving in a space of that should say large space. Oh, somehow this got miscopied, so every word, every statement here should have a not in front of it. Weak Yang-Mills, strong world sheet, large space-time curvature. That's a blip. That, I don't know how that happened. Okay. So the string theory ceases to be a useful means of calculation as you deform from here down to here. But it shows that in principle, you can turn the 3 plus 1 dimensional problem into a 1 plus 1 dimensional problem. And as we all know, 1 plus 1 dimensional quantum field theory is much easier than 3 plus 1 dimensional quantum field theory. Of course, we don't have a clear characterization of what that world sheet theory is, but this is, again, a strong indication that it exists. An interesting feature that it has to have. But that's actually far to the future because, again, the running coupling is very complicated. There's much less symmetry. It certainly would be useful to get some understanding of strings moving in spaces of high curvature and therefore to understand the Yang-Mills, the N equals 4 theory, not just at large coupling where the ADS description is good, but also at small intermediate coupling. It has an interesting property. So this is a string theory. It's a sum over world sheets. You're quantizing a one-dimensional object, which is described by a smooth field theory. But we know that somehow it must be that as we turn up the coupling in this one plus one-dimensional field theory, the string ceases to look continuous because it has to begin to look like, to arbitrarily good accuracy, a collection of point-like partons. Somehow this thing becomes dynamically this thing. And you can get a heuristic idea of what's happening. It must be that, okay, so the ADS space is getting smaller and more highly curved. The string is actually fluctuating over vast ranges of the ADS space then. And these points must be, in some sense, very close to the boundary of ADS space. One way to think about that is simply that, in general, things in the interior of ADS space are in the infrared. They're fuzzed out. They're large. Anything which is point-like must lie near the boundary. So somehow the string fluctuates, and the bits that carry space-time, energy, and momentum get stuck out near the boundary. And look like partons. But it's hard to make this quantitative. Lots of people have tried, just no success yet. Maybe the most recent attempts are by Gopakumar, who has guessed. He's shown that there is a plausible guess for the correlation functions of the world sheet theory in this limit. I don't think there's a strong argument that his guess is right. It's simply the information that you have from the duality in some sense is the integrated correlation functions in the CFT, but he's shown that there is a plausible guess for the local correlation functions in the CFT. It may be right. It's very interesting guess. One comment about the connection with integrability is I think this is an existence proof for something which should be there and hasn't yet been found, which is higher symmetries in the N equals 4S matrix. Because this is a string, and we know that there are these Wilson line charges that act on the string, and the Wilson line built out of the flat connection. And we know that the dynamics of the world sheet preserve these charges. And that should be true, again, even in strong coupling. It appears to be an exact statement of the quantum theory, so it should be true even in strong coupling. And what that means is there should be higher charges that are exactly preserve the dynamics of this system. But these are just, again, free partons scattering. This is not exactly the X matrix calculated by Byrne and Kossauer et al., because these gluons are in a total color singlet state. So it's actually one level less planar than the S matrix that they calculate. But there probably is an analogous statement for their S matrix as well. But for the S matrix in which you have a bunch of gluons in a net color singlet in the in state, they scatter and you have a net color singlet in the out state. The fact that there are higher symmetries here implies there are higher symmetries here. And I know people have looked for higher symmetries of the N equals 4S matrix and not found them, but I think they must be there. So since the strong coupled limit of the gauge theory, although it has this interesting limiting behavior, doesn't seem solvable, maybe it would be useful to just think about all values of the coupling at once and ask, can we solve the theory? If the background fields of the ADS theory were Nouveau-Schwarz fields, then there are general theorems that would say with this much symmetry we would have a current algebra and we could solve it by standard methods of current algebra. But because of this annoying fact that the background fields are Ramon-Ramon fields, where we're sort of in a totally different class of world shape control field theory, and we have to work vastly harder. Yosef and Radu and I, at least look, we said morally there deserved to be more symmetry here, and we found these higher charges, and then we went to the library to find the book that would tell us how to calculate everything, and we're still looking for that book. We did this in the classical limit of the world sheet theory, and Berkowitz argued that it extends to the fully quantized string. I haven't studied Berkowitz's work. I don't understand his formalism deeply, but it certainly sounds plausible. But what do you do with them? Okay, so just briefly, my thoughts about this. So with Niemann, we studied the beta ansatz around the relativistic ground state of the world sheet theory, the state that has no charge, no particles in it, rather than the state that is generally studied in which there's a chemical potential, a density of charge. And we studied it not in the real theory, but in an analog theory, because for that theory, we could more or less look up in the literature what the S-matrix was. The advantage is, again, that the world sheet Lorentz's variance is manifest, and also that there are standard techniques for finding the S-matrix. The disadvantage is that to apply at least the techniques that Zamolodchikov used to get the S-matrix, you need to find a massive integral... to find the S-matrix, you need to do one of two things. You need to find either a massless integral perturbation so that you can use standard analytic properties of S-matrices, which only exist really in massive theories, or you need to find an integrable way to empty the an integral cutoff theory, an integrable way to empty the C. And so in any case, we have no clue as to how to do either of these for the world sheet theory of interest. And okay, yes, Matthias. I'm sorry. This is the world. I'm sorry. I guess I should use different S's. Thank you for the clarification. So the S matrix I was referring to on the previous slide was the space-time S matrix being calculated by Bernd-Kassauer et al. And the S matrix here suddenly is the world sheet S matrix for excitation on the world sheet. The analog of the Magnan S matrix, but for excitations around the relativistic state rather than around the state of large charge density. Now, actually, I think that what everybody else is doing is probably sensible. First of all, non-zero charge density does give mass to the magnons. Their dispersion relation is no longer relativistic, and so there really is a world sheet S matrix one can talk about. What you lose is that the Lorentz invariance and the conformal invariance of the underlying theory are obscured because you've got this J, the S matrix no longer depends on rapidity differences, as various people have remarked. But when you think about it, the good thing about this deformation is that it's a spontaneous breaking of the symmetries, not an explicit breaking. All of the symmetries are still symmetries of the world sheet Hamiltonian, just not of the state that you're studying. And so the fact that these symmetries are there should, in fact, constrain the S matrix. And I'm trying to work this out. I hope to have similar. Okay, so this is an extension in the same direction as the work of Janek, who considered crossing symmetry, but there should be additional relations coming from the fact that there are symmetries in the system, even though they're spontaneously broken. So again, this is work in progress. I think there are relations that can be written down, and I'm trying to write them down. Okay, so the second half of my talk, the Pomeron. So first of all, in my plot of running coupling constants, I had this thing I called ADS-QCD, which is this model world. It's not like the real world because at high energy, things are strongly coupled. But it's like it in some ways because at low energy, there are mass gaps in confinement and maybe chiral symmetry breaking. And the nice thing is that because the gauge side is strongly coupled at all energies, the string side is weakly coupled at all energies, and you can calculate anything you want to calculate. Everything that you would like to calculate in real QCD or measure, you can calculate in ADS QCD. So it's fun to do so. Sometimes you learn things. also, well, for many, some, what you're doing here are prototypes for what you would someday hope to do for the real theory. It's important that, well, what one learns from this is going to be a fairly far stretch from the kind of precision QCD that Byrne and Kossauer talk about. At the LHC, one is interested in events where there's a lot of energy in a single parton, a small number of partons. This theory doesn't have partons because it's strongly coupled to high energy. You don't make single partons. When you excite things, you excite the entire hadron. It turns out, this is not my subject, but of course, as most of you know, for things like heavy ion collisions, where instead you have large amounts of energy spread among many hadrons, this is a much better analog, and even quantitatively, for the real theory. But I'm not thinking of it, I'm not trying to really make quantitative connection with real QCD, but I think, in fact, this is a very nice pedagogical laboratory. You can learn things from studying this much more quickly than you can learn them in other ways, and I'll illustrate that. Okay, in particular, there's this BFKL story, which you've heard about from Lopatov and from Gorsky. So most of the people here are calculating anomalous dimensions. And then there's this other thing, the BFKL operator, which has eigenvalues. And there's a connection between those two things, which is simple but subtle. And I don't think, well, anyway, I think one can make precise what it is, and it's very useful to have insight from string theory in making precise what is the connection between those two things. So Regi behavior, if you consider a 2-to-2 scattering process with fixed momentum transfer and large center of mass, then both the strong interaction and flat space string theory show Regi behavior even in the Born approximation, that is, in the amplitude in which you exchange only a single particle across here. That is, the amplitudes grow as a power of x that depends continuously, varies continuously as you vary the momentum transfer. In theories with a finite number of particle states, exchange of individual particles can only give you integer powers of s. And so you have fixed versus Regi behavior for the exponents. Can illustrate this with the Virasoro-Shapiro amplitude. So the textbook amplitude, the general. Everything I'm saying for closed strings, one could say for open strings as well. And so this could have been the Veneziano amplitude that Veneziano basically guessed many years ago. But since it's easier on the ADS side to talk about closed strings, I'll write down closed string quantities. There is the scattering of four tachyons in flat space time. And if you take its Regi limit, you get, as advertised, a continuously varying power of S times some kinematic factors. Notice that the power of S, the Regi trajectory here, is linear in T, the momentum transfer. Also, there are poles here in the amplitude, real physical exchanges, precisely when this exponent takes an integer value. And that corresponds to exchange, those poles correspond to exchange of a real particle of definite spin. So here's a graph of the trajectories again, this exponent alpha of t as a function of t. And what I just showed you is that for the flat space string it's linear, but for real QCD it does this. And up in the time-like region where this is most familiar to everyone, the signature of this behavior is whenever you cross an integer value of alpha, you have a real particle, and the real particles sit on straight lines in this plane, as do the string excitations. But we know, for various reasons, both direct measurements, well, we know that as we go to the space-like region, they have to differ because this continued fall off of the exponent is related to the fact that the string theory has very soft amplitudes at high energy, whereas the QCD has partons, these amplitudes are not exponentially soft at high energy, and so the trajectories cannot continue to drop as well. And BFKL is a calculation of this part of the curve in QCD. Something which is curious is that out here at large positive T, we're talking about glue balls, which are explicitly non-perturbative. Here at negative T, we're talking in BFKL about perturbative states, two gluon states. When you're thinking roughly, you would say if T is large, things should be weakly coupled in a gauge theory, but what you see is it's not so simple, and it's never that simple in Minkowski spacetime. Here, whether you're dominated evidently, and we'll see a reason why shortly, what the question of whether you're dominated by short distance or long distance doesn't depend just on the magnitude of the momentum transfer, but also on its sign. So we have now this model of QCD, ADS QCD, and so we can simply ask, what do Reggie amplitudes look like in this theory? So let me first give you a simplified description of the calculation. Here is the metric. Here's the metric of ADS space. So a flat metric with a fifth coordinate r, little r, and an r-dependent redshift, and then a metric in the r direction. And we're interested in the regime of large Tuck parameter, where the capital R that characterizes the size of this space, its curvature, is much larger than the size of a string. And also I mentioned breaking of conformal invariance. The simplest model of that is simply to take ADS space and restrict the radial coordinate to lie above some infrared cutoff. That's a model of the real geometries, like the Klebanov-Strassler geometry. But in fact, in this problem, most of the dynamics happens out at large R anyway, and so the infrared cutoff plays little role. The key thing is, and this was exploited by Randall and Sundrum as a means of getting multiple scales, hierarchies of scales in particle physics, is that the gravitational redshift appears in the relation between the momentum as measured by a local inertial observer, a little tiny observer in 10 dimensions, and the conserved momentum that would be seen by a four-dimensional observer who just sort of looks at these coordinates x mu. Now, hadrons are, which say, are, for example, glue balls, are cavity modes in ADS. They're strings moving in ADS. Their wave function would be some plane wave in the visible coordinates and then some normalizable function of the fifth coordinate. I'll say later on why it should be that a hadron might have a wave function that depends on a fifth coordinate, but this is what you have in ADS space. They're cavity modes. And when two of these scatter against each other, since the ADS space is large, we can make a first approximation that the scattering is local in this ADS coordinate R, and we can simply coherently superpose amplitudes for scattering at different values of R. And so, in the Reggie limit, we have a low. We lost a tilde. So we have a process happening in 10 dimensions with some 10-dimensional kinematics. And so the relevant exponent, there should be a tilde on that T. The tilde signifies the fact that the amplitude is governed by the kinematics as seen by a local inertial observer. T tilde was the momentum as seen in that observer's units. It differs from the four-dimensional kinematic variable T by, again, this redshift factor, which should be squared, I see. And it should be squared there as well. And so there is, for scattering, I told you again, we think about this, there are these two wave functions approaching each other, they scatter, but again, we coherently superpose all the places that scattering might have occurred. And so, depending on where it occurs in this fifth dimension, you have a Reggie formula, but with a different slope. Here's the slope, again, being squared. And if we plot all of the different Reggie trajectories that this represents, then depending on whether the scattering occurs at small r in the infrared region or at large r in the ultraviolet region, we see a very different Reggie slope. And again, all it is Randall Sundrum physics. All it is the translation between the scales of a local inertial observer and the scales of the four-dimensional observer. And this looks already not too bad of a cartoon of the QCD trajectory, which was straight at high energy and leveled off at negative T. Also, this is small r infrared here and large r ultraviolet out here, so already the first puzzle is answered. But we can do better. We can do much better. Well, we can do better. So the Venezianos, the amplitude of the Venezianos guessed, when you try to understand it more deeply, can be represented as an integral over a correlation function of vertex operators representing the incoming strings, integral representation. And now in the Reggie limit, this integral is dominated by small w. So w is again the position of the one vertex operator which isn't gauge fixed, and is dominated by the case that v1 and v2, which are the two hadrons on the left side of the scattering process, if those vertex operators come close together, you can expand then and get a simpler integral, which looks like it diverges, but in fact, as always with these integral representations of string amplitudes, you have to define them by appropriate analytic continuation. So if you pretend that this exponential is a wiggly exponential rather than a real exponential, then you see that the integral will be dominated by W of order 1 over S. S is the big number in the problem, the high center of mass energy. This integral is dominated by small w, and just this simplified integral gives you the limiting behavior directly that I described before. Now, the fact that the amplitude is dominated by small values of w means that we can use the operator product expansion. So all of this should be familiar if you've read my book, and if you're confused, you should buy more copies of my book. When two vertex operators come together, there's a standard operator product expansion that governs their behavior. However, here we have an additional parameter besides their separation, we have this large energy, and the separation times the energy of order 1. So in the operator product expansion, you have to keep some specific additional terms, namely all terms involving first derivatives but no higher of the world sheet field X. And so if you take this operator product expansion, this improved or Reggie operator product expansion, and insert it into the integral that we had over written operator positions, you can do the integral before taking the expectation value. That's useful to do. It gives you a more universal result. It's the analog of the OPE. So this is on the world sheet. You do this integral over vertex operator positions using the OPE, and what you find is something that looks like a vertex operator, except that the tensor part here is raised to a power which is in general fractional. So here we have something which, again, already at the operator level, it encodes, first of all, the Reggie behavior. So I've sort of gone to a frame in which this is S. So this is the Reggie behavior. These are the kinematic factors you keep seeing. And this is a vertex operator, sort of, but it involves fractional powers of fields, which is a very strange thing. Not something that you see in the textbooks. So what's happening is that the amplitude in this limit factorizes into strings 1 and 2 scattering to form a Pomeron, whose vertex operator is this, and the Pomeron then couples to states 3 and 4. Now the Pomeron is not a physical particle, it doesn't propagate really in space, the amplitude only has poles representing production of a real particle for integer values of that spin. If you think about this, Pomeron lives in an unusual Hilbert space because there's a standard dictionary that maps vertex operators to string oscillations, and a fractional power of this vertex operator translates into a fractional power of the number of string excitations. So it's a weird thing. Again, you're exchanging strings, but live in a non-standard Hilbert space. And there must be a formal way to think about this, but I don't know it. And similarly, in the BFKL calculation, you're exchanging two gluon pairs, but they live in a Hilbert space in which the spin, or the boost eigenvalue, to be more precise, can take continuous values rather than discrete values, as it does for ordinary particle states. The Pomeroy, by the way, this vertex operator, as you know, vertex operators in string theory have to satisfy physical state conditions, and this one, although it lives in an unusual Hilbert space, does. In particular, it satisfies the mass shell condition. The Virasoro generator is the number of oscillators plus momentum squared, which means it's the spin. I'm calling this the spin. It's really the boost. Spin over 2 minus this momentum T. And so the physical state condition relates J, the exponent, to T. And so the Regi trajectory here is really defined by the physical state condition for these strings, but in this unusual Hilbert space of indefinite spin. Okay, so we can extend all of this to ADS space-time. The only difference is you've got this fifth coordinate. You've got wave function dependent on the fifth coordinate. The physical state condition for the Pomeroy now involves, instead of T, the four-dimensional momentum squared, involves the five-dimensional momentum squared, the five-dimensional Laplacian. And so in addition to the term we've been talking about, the running string tension, there's a second derivative term in the radial direction. And so in the Regi limit of S to this operator, it generates the running slope I talked about, but also diffusion with respect to log R. And in the BFKL formalism, there is an analogous structure, S to the BFKL Hamiltonian, which also generates diffusion, but it's with respect to the size of the two gluon state. And these are really the same thing. Because there's a way to think about what the radial coordinate is in ADS-CFT. If you have a hadron that has some center of mass position and some size, R is essentially, so the center of mass is obvious, that's x mu. R is proportional to the size of the hadron. And so, in fact, this diffusion with respect to log R is directly the same thing as the diffusion at BFKLC. And in fact, there are other places in hadronic physics where there's an approximate locality with respect to the size of the hadron. For example, something called color transparency, where a very tiny hadron can plow through a bunch of nuclear matter without doing anything. If you take the extreme asymptotics of this, it's dominated by the lowest eigenvalue of this operator. You got an analog quantum mechanics problem, and the lowest eigenvalue gives you the Regi exponent, which this is at large t. The theory is conformal, so it's just a number. This is this 2 minus a correction of order 1 over root lambda. This is the strong coupling analog of the weak coupling calculation of BFKL, this famous exponent. The BFKL calculation was a tour de force that took 10 or more years of finding a way to organize the Feynman diagrams. And so it's very satisfying to see the same physics emerge directly on the string side. Also, the BFKL calculation is a leading log sum. It's not exactly clear what happens to it at strong coupling, and this shows that, in fact, the qualitative physics they see continues to strong coupling. So my final point, the relation between the BFKL operator and the anomalous dimension. So in ADS-CFT, these vertex operators are string states moving in the bulk, and they map to local operators in the gauge theory. And these are the twist two local operators. They're the operators which have the lowest dimension for given spin. For example, J equals 2 is the energy momentum tensor, which is dual to the graviton. That's the graviton vertex operator. When you talk about operators of definite spin and look for their dimensions, you have a normalizable mode and a non-normalizable mode. The BFKL calculation is dominated again by the lowest state in that analog quantum mechanics problem. It's in fact the state of dimension 2, which sits right between the normalizable and the non-normalizable solution. So, in fact, the same physical state condition determines both the dimension and the Reggie exponent. To find the dimension, you fix J and solve for D. To find the BFKL exponent, you set D equals 2 and solve for J. It's that simple. And this argument holds at strong coupling, but this seems very robust, and it should continue to weak coupling, and I believe it does. So there's a very simple relation between the BFKL and the anomalous dimension calculation, but there's also a subtle relation, because something unexpected, at least to me, happens. At weak coupling, this physical state condition has two branches to its solution. The anomalous dimension branch, in which the dimension is the spin plus 2 plus a loop plus loop corrections, and the branch studied by BFKL, in which the spin is 1 plus corrections, and these are two different lines in the J and dimension plane. By the way, D again is dimension, not, is operator dimension, not space-time dimension. I apologize for the notation. These are two different lines in the dimension and spin plane. And actually, as you approach their intersection from either direction, the functions here blow up. They have poles because each of these calculations leads you to digamma functions. So the way when I expressed that this connection between the two things, that you're simply solving for J versus solving for D, it sounds as though they're basically the same, that the actual field theory calculation is the same, you're just reorganizing it. But in fact, it really is two different field theory calculations, because here's the anomalous dimension branch, here's the BFKL branch. They join smoothly, and in fact, the condition that they join smoothly puts conditions on the anomalous dimensions as they approach this, oh, that's J equals plus 1, as they approach this intersection, J equals plus 1, and similarly conditions on this. So the anomalous dimension, this picture, by the way, is for the N equals 4 gauge theory. We're talking about things that are precise in the conformal limit, like anomalous dimensions. For QCD, there's some running. That's more complicated. Forget about it. For the N equals 4 theory, the anomalous dimension is only half of the story. Because there's also the BFKL branch of the solution, and these join up into a smooth whole. So there is a larger structure that may be interesting to explore, of which the anomalous dimensions are only one piece. I think, by the way, this is well known. This is well known to Lopatov and those who work with him, but it's very hard to find a statement like this in the literature. I have never seen this graph drawn. Maybe it appears somewhere. I've only seen the little bit of it near J equals 1 sort of blown up so you don't see the whole structure. But anyway, it is well known in some sense, but the structure becomes much clearer from the string side, where this is the string physical state condition. It's smooth, there's no branches, the branches only appear as you take lambda less than 1, and this curve begins to approach this curve. So, I don't have any real conclusions. In the first part, I've tried to tell you about some directions I think are interesting. In the second part, I've tried to show you that the insight you get from the ADS side of duality can teach you things even about pure perturbative gauge theory, conceptual things. So thank you.
Thank you very much for this nice talk. Please. Wait.
Oh. Oops.
Maybe a naive question, because I'm not an expert here. So you said that Pomeron is dual to graviton, right?
Sorry?
You said that the Pomeron is dual to graviton, right?
The Pomeron is dual to this whole set of states One of which is the graviton. One point on that line is the graviton.
Okay.
Yes.
Now there is also gravitina.
Yes.
The question is, what is dual to gravitina at the field theory site? So, is there some analog?
Well, I mean, yeah, there would be. You would exchange. I mean, so the I should say, the BFKL calculation is a special case of, you know, of a much larger set. You can consider also Pomerons with other quantum numbers, including fermion number or R charge. And I don't know if these calculations have been done. I know the Potthoff and collaborators have looked at not just two gluons, but many gluons. I don't know if they've looked at, for example, states that had additionally fermions or scalars. But certainly there would be, you know, flavored and fermionic Pomerons as well, and they would be dual to the gravitino.
So, well, if this is correct, then there should be some supersymmetric analog of Pomeron kind of Pomerina. So it may be its bound state of regized gluon and regized gluon. So I don't know.
Right, yeah, I mean, that's exactly what it is. And that's exactly what it is. Its intercept will be higher, even aside from Susie breaking. Which will remove it from the low energy spectrum. Its intercept will be higher, I think. I assume it will be higher. I think. Okay. Yeah.
I also have maybe a naive question, because if we're talking about the space-time S matrix of n equals 4 super Young Mills.
Yes.
Now, this being an exactly conformally invariant theory, there are no asymptotic states and hence no S matrix. So what did you really mean? So that's question number one. And secondly, you were speculating about an infinite number of conserved charges.
Yes.
In this S matrix.
Yes.
Now, there are very old arguments that showing that if you're in higher dimensions than 2, and you have an infinite set of such charges, then the only solution is S equals 1.
Okay, good. So, as to the first, the S matrix I'm talking about is the one that Bern and Kossauer make their living calculating. So you should ask that of them. But in fact, what they really are calculating at the end of the day is the usual thing where you add infrared particles and talk about jet-like observables that are physical. For my purpose, I'd rather maybe think about just giving the Higgs fields a very, very tiny VeV to make the theory just non-conformal enough that I can talk about isolated particles, but without really changing its structure. So it's like putting an infrared cutoff on, but one that's physical. It comes from Higgsing. So, anyway, so there are two answers to your question. I'm thinking of the second one because in some ways I think it's simpler, you know, to calculate. The second half of your question was about a no-go theorem. And, of course, you're talking about a no-go theorem which has already been violated once, because the same class of no-go theorems was used by Coleman and Mandula to show that you couldn't have supersymmetry. So this would be yet another violation. These theories have assumptions. These theorems have assumptions, and certainly the assumption in Coleman Mandula is for ordinary local charges which are additive on the states. Whereas the charges here are not additive. They're non-local on the world sheet. They involve multilinears in terms of the states. So you're already outside the range of Coleman-Mandula theorem.
Okay, I guess in view of the time, we have to close now. Let's thank Joe again. And remember, the bus is leaving at 9:45.